This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm pleased to open tonight's program with the poetry of one of America's greatest poets, Emily Dickinson. I'll be reading from a couple of books, The Complete Poems of Emily Dickinson, edited by Thomas H. Johnson, and Open Me Carefully, Emily Dickinson's Intimate Letters to Susan Huntington Dickinson. I'll also be playing recordings of Emily Dickinson's poetry, read by Teresa Gallagher, and I'll read some poems myself. In addition, now and then I'll throw in some music that was inspired by the poetry of Emily Dickinson. In the introduction of The Complete Poems of Emily Dickinson, Johnson writes, "There are certain significant dates in American literary history during the 19th century. One was August 21, 1837, when Emerson, before the Phi Beta Kappa Society at Cambridge, Massachusetts, delivered in the presence of Thoreau's graduating class his American Scholar Address. Another was the day early in July 1855, when Whitman, for the convenience of private reading only, began circulating printed copies of his Leaves of Grass. And a third was April 15, 1862, when Thomas Wentworth Higginson received a letter from Emily Dickinson enclosing four of her poems. Dickinson was 31 years old and was writing a professional man of letters to inquire whether her verses breathed. Higginson was still living at Worcester, Massachusetts, where he had recently resigned his pastorate of a free church and was beginning to establish a reputation as essayist and a lecturer in the cause of reforms. She dared bring herself to his attention because she had just read his letter to a young contributor, practical advice for those wishing to break into print, and the lead article in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Charge your style with life, he commented, and went on to declare that the privilege of bringing forward new genius was fascinating. His article happened to appear exactly at the moment that Emily Dickinson was ready to seek criticism. She knew him to be a liberal thinker, interested in the status of women in general and women writers in particular. Though the article drew responses, all of which Higginson judged not for publication, he sensed some quality in the enclosures of the letter posted at Amherst, which elicited a reply. He asked for more verses, inquired her age, her reading, and her companionships. The importance of the correspondence with Higginson, thus initiated and continuing throughout Emily Dickinson's life, cannot be exaggerated. In the first place, the four poems she initially selected reveal that in 1862 the poet was no longer a novice, but an artist whose strikingly original talent was fully developed. She enclosed Safe in Their Alabaster Chambers, I'll Tell You How the Sun Rose, The Nearest Dream Recedes Unrealized, and We Play at Paste. I'm going to go ahead and play these four poems right now, two read by Teresa Gallagher and two read by myself.
Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. Grand go the years in the crescent above them. Worlds scoop their arcs, and firmaments row, diadems drop, and doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow.
The nearest dream recedes, unrealized. The heaven we chase, like the June bee before the schoolboy, invites the race. Stoops to an easy clover, dips, evades, teases, deploys, then to the royal clouds lifts his light pinnace, heedless of the boy, staring, bewildered, at the mocking sky, homesick for the steadfast honey. Ah, the bee flies not that brews that rare variety.
I'll tell you how the sun rose, a ribbon at a time. The steeples swam in amethyst, the news like squirrels ran. The hills untied their bonnets, the bobolinks begun. Then I said softly to myself, that must have been the sun. But how he set, I know not. There seemed a purple stile that little yellow boys and girls were climbing all the while, till when they reached the other side, a dominie in gray put gently up the evening bars, and led the flock away.
We play at paste till qualified for pearl, then drop the paste and deem ourself a fool. The shapes, though, were similar, and our new hands learned gem tactics, practicing sands. From the introduction of the complete poems of Emily Dickinson. From her youth, Emily Dickinson had been writing poetry, and the realization of her destiny as a poet who must, during her lifetime, expect to maintain a barefoot rank came in 1862. Meanwhile, probably in 1858, she winnowed her earlier verses, transcribing those she chose to save into the earliest of the famous packets. Always in ink, the packets are gatherings of 4, 5, or 6 sheets of folded stationery, loosely held together by thread, looped through them in the spine at 2 points equidistant from the top and bottom. Of the 49 packets, 46 appear to include all the verses written between 1858 and 1865, the years of great creativeness. 3 were assembled later, about 1866, 1871, and 1872. All of the packet poems are either fair copies or semi-final drafts, mostly fair copies, and they constitute 2/3 of the entire body of her poetry. The increasing momentum after 1860 reached its peak in 1862 and sustained its full power for 3 more years. Thereafter, throughout her life, Emily Dickinson continued to write poetry, but never again with the urgency she experienced in the early 1860s, when she fully developed her flood subjects on the themes of living and dying. With paradoxes of extraordinary insight, she repeatedly gives relationship to the ideas and experience which exist in time, but never are a part of it. Here are a few more poems by Emily Dickinson.
The dying need but little, dear. A glass of water's all. A flower's unobtrusive face to punctuate the wall. A fan, perhaps. A friend's regret and certainty that one no color in the rainbow perceives when you are gone.
I was the slightest in the house. I took the smallest room. At night, my little lamp and book and one geranium. So stationed I could catch the mint that never ceased to fall, and just my basket let me think, I'm sure, that this was all. I never spoke unless addressed, and then 'twas brief and low. I could not bear to live aloud, the racket shamed me so. And if it had not been so far, and any one I knew were going, I had often thought how noteless I could die.
How the old mountains drip with sunset, how the hemlocks burn, how the dun brake is draped in cinder by the wizard sun, how the old steeples hand the scarlet till the ball is full. Have I the lip of the flamingo that I dare to tell? Then how the fire ebbs like billows, touching all the grass with a departing sapphire feature, as a duchess passed. How a small dusk crawls on the village till the houses blot, and the odd flambeau no men carry glimmer on the street. How it is night in nest and kennel, and where was the wood? Just a dome of abyss is bowing into solitude. These are the visions flitted Guido, Titian never told. Domenichino dropped his pencil, paralyzed with gold.
Her breast is fit for pearls, but I was not a diver. Her brow is fit for thrones, but I have not a crest. Her heart is fit for home. I, a sparrow, build there, sweet of twigs and twine, my perennial nest.
The rat is the concisest tenant. He pays no rent, repudiates the obligation, on schemes intent. Balking our wit to sound or circumvent, hate cannot harm a foe so reticent. Neither decree prohibits him, lawful as equilibrium.
It's not surprising at all to know that many composers, musicians, singers, and other artists have been inspired by the poetry of Emily Dickinson. One of the better-known composers inspired by her work was Aaron Copland. I'm going to read Dickinson's poem, Nature, the Gentlest Mother, and then play Copeland's composition inspired by the poem. The performers are Barbara Bonney and Andre Previn. Nature, the gentlest mother, is impatient of no child, the feeblest or the waywardest, her admonition mild. In forest and the hill, by traveler, be heard, restraining rampant squirrel or too impetuous bird. How fair her conversation, a summer afternoon, her household, her assembly, and when the sun go down. Her voice among the aisles incite the timid prayer of the minutest cricket, the most unworthy flower. When all the children sleep, she turns as long away as will suffice to light her lamps, then bending from the sky, with infinite affection and infiniter care, her golden finger on her lip, wills silence everywhere. You just heard Nature, the Gentlest Mother, Emily Dickinson's poem. The composer was Aaron Copland, performed by Barbara Bonney and Andre Previn. Another American composer who was inspired by the work of Emily Dickinson was John Woods Duke. Here is Dickinson's poem, Let Down the Bars, O Death, followed by John Woods' composition, sung by soprano Carol Bogard. This is from her CD, A Collection of American Songs. Let down the bars, O death. The tired flocks come in, whose bleeding ceases to repeat, whose wandering is done. Thine is the stillest night, thine the securest fold. Too near thou art for seeking thee, too tender to be told. From the introduction of Open Me Carefully, Emily Dickinson's intimate letters to Susan Huntington Dickinson. In June 1852, Emily Dickinson sent a letter to her friend Susan Huntington Gilbert, who was away from home teaching mathematics at Robert Archer School for Girls in Baltimore, Maryland. The letter was carried and delivered to Susan by Emily's father, Edward Dickinson, on his way to Baltimore to serve as a delegate to the National Whig Convention. "Why can't I be a delegate to the great Whig convention?" asks Dickinson in the letter's postscript. "Don't I know all about Daniel Webster and the tariff and the law? Then, Susie, I could see you during a pause in the session." Placed for Susan to see when she first unfolded the letter is Emily's tender instruction, "Open me carefully." Over the next four decades, Emily Dickinson would write to Susan more frequently than to any of her other 99 known correspondents, including editor Thomas Wentworth Higginson. The voluminous correspondence with Susan constitutes one of two major bodies of work that Dickinson bequeathed to the world, the other being the more than 800 poems that she collected in her hand-bound manuscript books or fascicles. Dickinson's poems, letters, and letter poems to Susan give us a rare glimpse into the poet's process of writing and revising. They also indicate that Susan herself, a published writer of poems, reviews, essays, and stories, was Emily's primary reader, the recipient of both drafts and finished poems. Yet, in spite of the sheer volume of correspondence between Susan and Emily, and despite compelling evidence of an ongoing literary dialogue between the two women, the relationship between Emily and Susan has been neglected, distorted, and obscured. Whereas pages and pages of academic speculation have been devoted to a mere three letter drafts that Dickinson wrote to a mysterious real or fictional character identified only as Master, the correspondence between Dickinson and Susan has received disproportionately little attention. Emily Dickinson died in 1886, and her poems were not introduced to the reading public until 1890, when editors Thomas Higginson and Mabel Loomis Todd released the first edition of Poems by Emily Dickinson. In the 100 years since that first publication, the story of Emily Dickinson and Susan Huntington Dickinson has only gradually emerged in the annals of Dickinson scholarship. In fact, most readers of Dickinson are unaware of the intense and long-lived relationship that was at the very core of the poet's emotional and creative life. Susan Huntington Gilbert and Emily Elizabeth Dickinson were born within days of each other in December 1830. They They may have known each other from girlhood. They certainly knew each other from adolescence. And they had begun to correspond by the age of 20. Their relationship spanned nearly 4 decades, and for 3 of those decades, the women were next-door neighbors. Together, Susan and Emily lived through the vicissitudes of a life closely shared. Susan's courtship, engagement, and eventual marriage to Emily's brother, Austin. Susan and Austin setting up home next door to the Dickinson homestead. The births of Susan and Austin's 3 children, and the tragic death of their youngest son. Anonymous individual publication of at least 10 of Dickinson's poems, and the deaths of parents and many friends. The correspondence, reproduced in Open Me Carefully, debunks much of the common Dickinson lore served up for decades by high school literature textbooks, television sitcoms, song lyrics, and literary biographies. According to these tenacious popular legends, Dickinson was an inaccessible, ethereal hermit, too rare for this earthly plane, and probably undone by unrequited love for any or all of several male suitors whose identities have been the stuff of speculation for countless readers. But why has this important correspondence, which lasted until Dickinson's death in 1886 and preoccupied Susan until her own death in 1913, been relatively ignored, if not suppressed? Emily Dickinson's writings to Susan were certainly not unknown. They've long been recognized as passionately literary, and many scholars have bickered and argued over the nature of Dickinson's obvious devotion to her sister-in-law. 2 cultural factors may have contributed to the discounting of this pivotal relationship. The first is the stereotypical 19th century vision of the poetess as a tortured, delicate woman dressed in virginal white, pining away in seclusion, removed from the vibrant knit, grit, and passion of normal life. It is this stereotype, encouraged by Dickinson's early editors, particularly Mabel Loomis Todd, that has preserved the popular image of Emily Dickinson as the recluse spinster Belle of Amherst.
Safe inside her private cell, the dust collects and keeps her thoughts circling from sleepless arc of summer moon. Quiet Amherst, hold your breath. Your lonely dawn is leaving. So goodbye for now. Dressed in white, the silence prime.
The second factor is the view of intimate female friendships in the 19th century. According to this view, women of Dickinson's time often indulged in highly romantic relationships with each other, but these relationships were merely affectionate. Some same-sex attractions, so the popular wisdom goes, had the character of an adolescent crush, rather than a mature, erotic love. As this correspondence shows, however, Emily and Susan's relationship surpasses in depth, passion, and continuity the stereotype of the intimate exchange between women friends of the period. The ardor of Dickinson's late teens and early 20s matured and deepened over the decades, and the romantic and erotic expressions from Emily to Susan continued until Dickinson's death in May 1886. When the Dickinson fascicles were turned over to Mabel Loomis Todd, Susan's crucial position as primary audience for Emily's poetry became an inconvenient and irrelevant piece of information that did not jibe with the popular image of a 19th century poetess. To editors of the time, the most marketable image of Dickinson the poet was that of the eccentric, reclusive, asexual woman in white. This mysterious figure necessarily wrote all alone, harboring some secret sorrow that no one else could understand or be privy to. There was simply no place in the official Dickinson biography for the revelation of an immediate confidant and audience for her poetry, particularly not one who lived next door. Loomis Todd was therefore willing to play up this solitary spinster characterization of Emily Dickinson in her editorial productions, and thus the role of Susan went entirely unmentioned in the earliest publications of Dickinson's works. Loomis Todd even refused Higginson's recommendation that Susan's obituary of Emily serve as the introduction to the 1890 poems. Instead, Loomis Todd used a 3-paragraph introduction by Higginson that proclaimed that Emily was, quote, a recluse by temperament and habit, and hence the mythology of Emily Dickinson, the recluse of Amherst, was cast.
You left me, sweet, 2 legacies. A legacy of love a heavenly father would content, had he the offer of. You left me boundaries of pain, capacious as the sea. Between eternity and time, your consciousness and me. That I did always love, I bring thee proof. That till I loved, I did not love enough. That I shall love alway, I offer thee that love is life, and life hath immortality. This dost thou doubt, sweet? Then have I nothing to show but Calvary. That love is all there is all we know of love. It is enough. The freight should be proportioned to the groove. While I was fearing it, it came, but came with less of fear, because that fearing it so long had almost made it dear. There is a fitting a dismay, a fitting a despair. 'Tis harder knowing it is due than knowing it is here. The trying on the utmost, the morning it is new, is terribler than wearing it a whole existence through. Wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with the compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, the sea! Might I but more tonight in thee!
And this concludes the Emily Dickinson portion of tonight's program. You heard me read from The Complete Poems of Emily Dickinson, edited by Thomas H. Johnson, and Open Me Carefully, Emily Dickinson's Intimate Letters to Susan Huntington Dickinson, edited by Ellen Louise Hart and Martha Nell Smith. You also heard Tess Gallagher reading some poems by Emily Dickinson, and music featured on the program included Nature, the Gentlest Mother, composed by Aaron Copland and performed by Barbara Bonney and Andre Previn, Let Down the Bars, O Death, composed by John Duke, performed by Carol Bogard, and a portion of The Bell of Amherst, performed by Quoting Napoleon. This is Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm Catherine Hastings. The first day of summer is just a few days away, so before moving on to the second portion of tonight's program, here's a summer song from Chad and Jeremy.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves as we walk by. Soft kisses on a summer's day, laughing all our cares away, just you and I. Sweet, sleepy warmth of summer nights, gazing at the distant lights in the starry sky. They say that all good things must end someday. Autumn leaves must fall. But don't you know that it hurts me so to say goodbye?
go. No, 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 no. When the rain beats against my window pane, I'll think of summer days again and dream of you. They say that all good things must end someday. But don't you know that it hurts me so to say goodbye to you? Wish you didn't have to go. No, 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 no. And when the rain beats against my window pane, I'll think of summer days again and dream of you.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Earlier in the Emily Dickinson portion of tonight's program, I mentioned that one of the significant dates in literary history was August 21, 1837, when Ralph Waldo Emerson delivered his American Scholar Address to Thoreau's graduating class. Next, I'm going to play some of Emerson's poems as performed by Archibald MacLeish, beginning with Give All to Love, Concord Hymn, Music, and then ending with Threnody. The word threnody means a song or hymn of mourning composed or performed as a memorial. Following Threnody by Emerson, we'll go out on Lou Harrison's Threnody for Carlos Chavez. Here is Archibald MacLeish.
Give all to love. Give all to love. Obey thy heart, friends, kindred, days, estate, good fame, plans, credit, and the muse. Nothing refuse. 'Tis a brave master. Let it have scope. Follow it utterly, hope beyond hope. High and more high it dives into noon, with wing unspent, untold intent. But it is a god, knows its own path and the outlets of the sky. It was never for the mean. It requireth courage stout, souls above doubt, valor unbending. It will reward. They shall return more than they were and ever ascending. Leave all for love. Yet hear me, yet one word more thy heart behoved, one pulse more of firm endeavor. Keep thee today, tomorrow, forever, free as an Arab of thy beloved. Cling with life to the maid, but when the surprise, first vague shadow of surmise, flits across her bosom young, of a joy apart from thee, free be she, fancy free, nor thou detain her vesture's hem, nor the palest rose she flung from her summer diadem. Though thou loved her as thyself, as a self of purer clay, though her parting dims the day, stealing grace from all alive, heartily know, when half gods go, the gods arrive. Concord Hymn, sung at the completion of the Battle Monument, April 19, 1836. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. The foe, long since in silence slept, alike the conqueror, silent sleeps, and time the ruined bridges swept down the dark stream which seaward creeps. On this green bank, by this soft stream, we set today a votive stone, that memory may their deed redeem when, like our sires, our sons are gone. Spirit, that made those heroes dare to die and leave their children free, bid time and nature gently spare the shaft we raise to them and thee. Music. Let me go where'er I will, I hear a sky-born music still. It sounds from all things old, it sounds from all things young, from all that's fair, from all that's foul, peals out a cheerful song. It is not only in the rose, it is not only in the bird, not only where the rainbow glows, nor in the song of woman heard, but in the darkest, meanest things. There, alway, alway, something sings. 'Tis not in the high stars alone, nor in the cups of budding flowers, nor in the red breast's mellow tone, nor in the bow that smiles and showers, but in the mud and scum of things. There, alway, alway, something sings. Threnody. The south wind brings life, sunshine, and desire, and on every mountain shadow breathes aromatic fire. But over the dead he has no power. The lost, he cannot restore. And looking over the hills, I mourn the darling who shall not return. I see my empty house, I see my trees repair their boughs, and he, the wondrous child whose silver warble wild outvalued every pulsing sound within the air's cerulean round, the hyacinthine boy for whom morn well might break and April bloom, the gracious boy who did adorn the world whereinto he was born, and by his countenance repay the favor of the loving day, has disappeared from the day's eye. Far and wide she cannot find him. My hopes pursue, they cannot bind him. Return this day the south wind searches and finds young pines and budding birches, but finds not the budding man. Nature, who lost, cannot remake him. Fate let him fall, fate can't retake him. Nature, fate, men, him seek in vain. And whither now, my truant, wise, and sweet, oh, whither tend thy feet? I had the right, a few days ago, thy steps to watch, thy place to know. How have I forfeited the right? Hast thou forgot me in a new delight? I hearken for thy household cheer, O eloquent child, whose voice an equal messenger conveyed thy meaning mild. What though the pains and joys whereof it spoke were toys, fitting his age and ken, yet fairest dames and bearded men who heard the sweet request, so gentle, wise, and grave, bended with joy to his behest, and let the world's affairs go by. A while to share his cordial game, or mend his wicker wagon frame, still plotting how their hungry ear that winsome voice again might hear. For his lips could well pronounce words that were persuasions. Gentlest guardians marked serene his early hope, his liberal mien, took counsel from his guiding eyes to make this wisdom earthly wise. Ah, vainly do these eyes recall the school march, each day's festival, when every morn my bosom glowed to watch the convoy on the road. The babe in willow wagon closed, with rolling eyes and face composed, with children forward and behind, like Cupids studiously inclined. And he, the chieftain, paced beside, the center of the troop allied, with sunny face of sweet repose to guard the babe from fancied foes. The little captain, innocent, took the eye with him as he went. Each village senior paused to scan and speak the lovely caravan. From the window I look out to mark thy beautiful parade, stately marching in cap and coat to some tune by fairies played, a music heard by thee alone to works as noble led thee on. Now love and pride, alas, in vain up and down their glances strain. The painted sled stands where it stood, the kennel by the corded wood, his gathered sticks to staunch the wall of the snow tower when snow should fall, the ominous hole he dug in the sand, and childhood's castles built or planned. His daily haunts I will discern, the poultry yard, the shed, the barn, and every inch of garden ground paced by the blessed feet around, and from the roadside to the brook whereinto he loved to look. Step the meek fowls where erst they ranged, the wintry garden lies unchanged, the brook into the stream runs on, but the deep-eyed boy is gone. On that shaded day, dark with more clouds than tempests are, when thou didst yield thy innocent breath in bird-like heavings unto death, night came, and nature had not thee. I said, we are mates in misery. The morrow dawned with needless glow. Each snowbird chirped, each fowl must crow. Each tramper started, but the feet of the most beautiful and sweet of human youth had left the hill and garden. They were bound and still. There's not a sparrow or a wren, there's not a blade of autumn grain, which the four seasons do not tend, and tides of life and increase lend. And every chick of every bird and weed and rock moss is preferred. O ostrich-like forgetfulness, O loss of larger in the less, was there no star that could be sent, no watcher in the firmament, no angels from the countless host that loiters round the crystal coast could stoop to heal that only child, nature's sweet marvel undefiled, and keep the blossom of the earth, which all her harvests were not worth. Not mine, I never called thee mine, but nature's heir. If I repine, and seeing rashly torn and moved, not what I made, but what I loved, grow early old with grief that thou must to the wastes of nature go, 'tis because a general hope was quenched, and all must doubt and grope, for flattering planets seem to say this child should ills of ages stay, by wondrous tongue and guided pen bring the flown muses back to men. Perchance not he, but nature ailed, the world and not the infant failed. It was not ripe yet to sustain a genius of so fine a strain, who gazed upon the sun and moon as if he came unto his own, and pregnant with his grander thought, brought the old order into doubt. His beauty once their beauty tried, they could not feed him, and he died, and wandered backward as in scorn, to wait an aeon to be born. Ill day which made this beauty waste, plight broken, this high face defaced. Some went and came about the dead, and some in books of solace read. Some to their friends the tidings say, some went to write, some went to pray, one tarried here, their hurried one, but their heart abode with none. Covetous death bereaved us all, to aggrandize one funeral. The eager fate which carried thee took the largest part of me, for this losing is true dying. This is lordly man's down-lying, this his slow but sure reclining, star by star his world resigning. O child of paradise, boy who made dear his father's home, in whose deep eyes men read the welfare of the times to come, I am too much bereft, the world dishonored thou hast left. O truths and nature's costly lie, O trusted broken prophecy, O richest fortune sourly crossed, born for the future, to the future lost. The deep heart answered, weepest thou? Worthier cause for passion wild, if I had not taken the child. And deemest thou, as those who pore with aged eyes short way before, think'st beauty vanished from the coast of matter, and thy darling lost? Taught he not thee, the man of eld, whose eyes within his eyes beheld heaven's numerous hierarchy span the mystic gulf from God to man? To be alone wilt thou begin when worlds of lovers hem thee in? Tomorrow, when the masks shall fall that dizen nature's carnival, the pure shall see by their own will which overflowing love shall fill. 'Tis not within the force of fate the fate conjoined to separate. But thou, my votary, weepest thou? I gave thee sight. Where is it now? I taught thy heart beyond the reach of ritual, Bible, or of speech, wrote in thy mind's transparent table as far as the incommunicable. taught thee each private sign to raise, lit by the supersolar blaze, past utterance and past belief, and past the blasphemy of grief, the mysteries of nature's heart, and though no muse can these impart, throb thine with nature's throbbing breast, and all is clear from east to west. I came to thee as to a friend. Dearest, to thee I did not send tutors, but a joyful eye, innocence that matched the sky, lovely locks, a form of wonder, laughter rich as woodland thunder, that thou mightst entertain a part, the richest flowering of all art. And as the great all-loving day through smallest chambers takes its way, that thou mightst break thy daily bread with prophet, savior, and head, that thou mightst cherish for thine own the riches of sweet Mary's son, boy rabbi, Israel's paragon. And thoughtest thou such guest would in thy hall take up his rest? Would rushing life forget her laws, fate's glowing revolution pause? High omens ask diviner guests, not to be conned to tediousness. And know my higher gifts unbind the zone that girds the incarnate mind. When the scanty shores are full with thought's perilous whirling pool, when frail nature can no more, then the spirit strikes the hour. My servant death with solving rite pours finite into infinite. Wilt thou freeze love's tidal flow whose streams through nature circling go, nail the wild star to its track on the half-climbed zodiac? Light is light which radiates, blood is blood which circulates, life is life which generates, and many seeming life is one. Wilt thou transfix and make it none? Its onward force too starkly pent in figure, bone, and lineament? Wilt thou uncalled interrogate, talker, the unreplying fate, nor see the genius of the whole ascendant in the private soul, beckon it when to go and come, self-announced its hour of doom? Fair the soul's recess and shrine, magic built to last a season, masterpiece of love benign, fairer that expansive reason whose omen 'tis and sign. Wilt thou not ope thy heart to know what rainbows teach and sunsets show, verdict which accumulates from lengthening scroll of human fates, voice of earth to earth returned, prayers of saints that inly burned, saying what is excellent as God lives is permanent. Hearts are dust, heart's loves remain, heart's love will meet thee again. Revere the Maker, fetch thine eye up to his style and manners of the sky. Not of adamant and gold built he heavens dark and cold. No, but a nest of bending reeds, flowering grass and scented weeds, or like a traveler's fleeing tent, or bow above the tempest bent, built of tears and sacred flames, and virtue reaching to its aims, built of furtherance and pursuing, not of spent deeds, but of doing. Silent rushes the swift Lord through ruined systems still restored, broad sowing, bleak and void to bless, plants with worlds the wilderness, waters with tears of ancient sorrow, apples of Eden ripe tomorrow. House and tenant go to ground, lost in God, in Godhead found.
Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard Threnody for Carlos Chavez, a work by the composer Lou Harrison from the CD Lou Harrison Chamber and Gamelan Works, performed by Susan Bates with the Kronos Quartet and the Manhattan Percussion Ensemble. Before that, you heard the poetry of Ralph Waldo Emerson, performed by Archibald MacLeish. And before that, poems of Emily Dickinson. As a matter of fact, we have time for a couple of more poems of Emily Dickinson read by Teresa Gallagher before we sign off.
I took my power in my hand and went against the world. 'Twas not so much as David had, but I was twice as bold. I aimed my pebble, but myself was all the one that fell. Was it Goliath was too large? Or only I too small? I went to heaven. 'Twas a small town, lit with a ruby lathed with down. Stiller than the fields at the full dew, beautiful as pictures no man drew. People like the moth of Mechlin, frames, duties of gossamer, and eider names. Almost contented I could be, mong such unique society. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise, as lightning to the children eased with explanation kind. The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. The brain is wider than the sky, for, put them side by side, the one the other will include with ease, and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb, as sponges, buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for lift them pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound.
I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, please do contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.